Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 489th episode of the Hollywood Reporter's Awards Chatter Podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is one of the last surviving stars of Hollywood's golden age, much of which he spent under contract to the greatest studio of all, MGM. He made his name as a child actor in films like 1950's Father of the Bride and 1951's Father's Little Dividend, displayed his dancing chops on screen for the first time at 19 in 1954's Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, became an Oscar nominee at just 23 for his supporting turn in 1957's Paid in Place, sang and danced as the leader of the Jets in an eventual Best Picture Oscar winner, 1961's West Side Story, gave a dramatic turn on both incarnations of David Lynch's TV classic Twin Peaks from 1990 to 1991, and then again in 2017, continued acting well into the 21st century opposite the likes of Ryan Gosling in 2011's Drive and under the direction of Quentin Tarantino in 2012's Django Unchained, and the list goes on. I'm talking, of course, about the great Russ, or as he was known at the start of his career, Rusty Tamblyn. Over the course of our conversation at the wonderful TCM Classic Film Festival in Hollywood, the 88-year-old and I discussed how he broke into the business and held his own alongside the likes of Cecil B. DeMille and Spencer Tracy, all before he cracked puberty, how a guy who had been a tumbler and a gymnast came to be an outstanding dancer, why, as he entered his 30s, having already achieved so much, he decided to drop out of the business, and what later brought him back, plus much more. And so without further ado, let's go to that conversation. All right, Mr. Tamblyn, thank you so much for doing this. Great to have you on the Hollywood Reporter's podcast. And on this one, we go through the major moments in each guest's life and career. So can we start with the first one? Where were you born and raised, and what did your parents do for a living?
I was born in Los Angeles, California, and at an early age.
Yes.
And my parents, my mother just was a housewife, and my father worked in, of course, originally he was in show business, and he was a Broadway performer, but now he worked in an aircraft, I think it was like North American or one of those plants that he was a... He worked there, and I'm not sure what all he did.
Sure. But he, I guess because of his experience, it sounded from what I read prepping for this that he was not interested in his kid getting into showbiz, right?
Yes, that's very true. He was not interested mainly in dancing, I guess. My mother took me to see him. Well, he may have gone, but they showed one of his old movies in this theater in Englewood. And so I went there and saw him on the big screen. And I said, oh, I just want to be like that, you know. he was so big, and it was so much fun. And he danced in it. And that's why I wanted to take dancing. But my mother but he didn't want me to take dancing, didn't want me to follow him. But my mother started me in dancing anyway, and finally told him when I did my first, I did a concert, you know, for kids. We went around doing lots of concerts at the hospitals and clubs and things like that. So he finally went and saw me in one, and then he was like a big supporter.
Yeah. Well, so you were clearly from a very early age. I think I had read, I don't know, was it 8 or 9? You were dancing very well, and or at least tumbling. Maybe you can explain. That's not a term many people know.
I was tap dancing. I took tap dancing, which is a lot different than modern dancing. Yeah. You know, so. I started taking tap dancing lessons and did really well at it for a couple of years from this a teacher named Bob Cole, who had a studio in England, in Englewood, and then I learned everything that he taught me. So he said, listen, I can't teach you anymore, but he said, I want you to go work for this. I recommend that you go and take lessons from the teacher that I worked with for a long time, whose name was Willie Colvin. And Willie was in Los Angeles, and he actually had a tour. It was called the Covans, and they had an act for a while, and it was and he was great, and he was a great tap dancer, terrific. A black man, and he's old, and he worked with a cane, you know, and he used to tap his foot and knew the cane, and that's how I learned to tap. And he was different than most tap dancers, sort of hop a lot, you know, and his stuff was all like down on the floor, and it was more like heel and toe work, you know, with lots of stuff on the floor. And that's how I learned to tap dance. It was great.
So can you connect the dots about how dance leads to acting? I had read that maybe Lloyd Bridges played a part in this.
Yes, he played a big part. He was actually the first director that I worked for. He had a play someone else wrote, but he was directing it at the Cornet Theater on La Cienega. And so I went in audition for it, and Lloyd gave me the part, and it was a great part of a young boy named Pai. and it was about a bunch of kids that go to this park place, and I end up getting killed in it, you know. So it was a very dramatic part,
yeah.
And it was that really got started. And it was a couple of directors and producers that saw the play and brought me to audition for Cecil B. DeMille.
I don't know if anyone else alive today can talk about working for Cecil B. DeMille. So I've got to ask you. First of all, were the kind of the legend is that he's walking around with these high socks and the speaker phone, and you know what I mean? Was all of that true? This showmanship?
It was definitely true.
Oh,
and not
God.
Only that, but a riding crop, and he had, you know, tight pants at the bottom and boots. And he was quite a character. He was the only other one I worked that was as much of a character was John Ford.
Who was also him. Yeah,
but that was later on.
Well, but with DeMille, you go into Paramount, you audition for Samson and Delilah. Did you even know? I know they had a thing. I think they called it the fishbowl, where people would go and audition in front of the mirror, not knowing it was a two-way mirror.
Exactly right.
Okay.
Yeah, and I auditioned with another actor, I guess, that was under contract. Can't even remember his name now, but he was under contract to Paramount, and it was just the two of us in this room. And there was a huge, big one-way mirror, you know, one-way glass. So it was pretty much known that somebody was going to be behind there. I didn't know if DeMille was going to be there or not. But we did the interview we did the audition, and I had memorized the words and everything. So and it was a scene that the actor played Samson. And
yeah.
And so I did the interview, and when I finished, the door opened, and out walked DeMille, and he said, "You've got the part, son." And that was the beginning of a long career.
Yeah.
But that didn't start for a long time. There was also an agent, a talent scout from RKO that brought me to audition for The Boy with Green Hair. And that came first. That was actually the first film that I did.
And I think the main legacy of that one, if I'm correct, is that you and another child actor, Dean Stockwell, became very good friends.
Very good. In fact, we lived together at one point later on. We became good friends on that one. And I had a funny story that he was the boy with green hair, of course, and he had a scene in there where they cut his hair off, and I happened to be there, so I grabbed a bunch of it and stuck it in my pocket, and it was like years and years later we were living together, and so it was his birthday coming up, and I just happened to find the green hair, and I looked in an old box, and I found the green hair and put it in a card and gave it to him. And
that's great.
He said, "This is the same." And I said, "Yeah, that's it." And then another funny thing that happened is one day we were living in Laurel Canyon.
Yeah.
And we drove down Laurel Canyon, and we were going to the market, and we stopped at a stoplight, And it was a red light, and we stopped there at the red light, and the car pulled up next to us. I was in the passenger seat. Dean was driving. And I looked over, and I saw this kid driving the car, had green hair. and so I punched Dean, you know, and I sort of elbowed him and said, "Dean, look at that. Do you believe it? This kid had green hair." So we were both staring at him for a minute, and the kid rolled his window down and said, "What's the matter? Haven't you seen anybody with green hair before?"
That's great.
That was as much as we said, but I thought when we were driving away, I thought, oh, man, I could have told him. I said, as a matter of fact, yes, and this guy sitting next to me is the first boy
that ever did, exactly.
And he had green hair before you were born.
Yeah, exactly. That's awesome. Awesome. Now, to come back, so that came out first. Samson and Delilah then comes out in 1949. And like a lot of people who I think were child actors, it seems like there are mixed experiences, mixed aspects of it, right? So on the one hand, you're leading probably a more exciting life than your peers. On the other hand, it's work, and sometimes people aren't always that nice. I guess that was kind of what happened with DeMille, right?
Yes, that is what happened. I had to do a scene with where I come up to Samson, and it was more than just us. There were like hundreds of extras all sitting up in the balconies, DeMille had two people that walked around with him, and one held a microphone. So every time he opened up, the guy would hold the microphone, and the other guy held a chair. And it better be there. Yeah. It always was, because DeMille wouldn't even look. He would just sit down, and the chair was there. So I had to do this scene where I come up to Samson, the Victor Mature played Samson, and I had to walk up to him and grab his arms. And say, "Samson, I've got my slingshot on my head." And I had a slingshot on my wrapped around my head. And I said, "I've got my slingshot on my head. We can fight our way out of here," which is what a kid would say.
Right.
And then he'd say, "No, Saul.
I hear many voices. Is the temple filled?
Packed like wheat in a shock.
Then go.
I've got my sling on my head. We could fight our way out."
"No, sir. Take Marion and leave the temple."
"But Samson..."
So I did it, and when I did it, and the first time, and the camera was over here, and I said, "I've got a slingshot on my head." And so, DeMille said, "Oh, cut. And he came and he said, "Listen, Russ," Rusty called me.
Yeah.
"Don't cover your face. When you touch the slingshot, touch it in the back or the side so that I can see you in the camera." And I said, "Okay." And there was all this commotion going on and the lighting. And that went all over the studio, because the guy was was holding the microphone, and DeMille was speaking to everybody and the whole thing. So we did the scene again. And I just forgot it. And I did the same thing again. I touched it. And so he said, cut. And he came in and he said, Rusty, says, "I told you, don't put your hand here." And he sort of slapped my hand, and he said, "Put it in the back." And he slapped it in the back of my hand. And it really shocked me, and I started to cry. I was only like 10 years old.
Yeah, yeah.
So I started to cry. I wondered where my mother was at this point.
Right.
But, I think I asked her later, "Where were you?"
Yeah.
She says, "You think I'm going to go up to Cecil B. DeMille and tell him what to do?"
Right. Well, it's just amazing how much you were, producing in terms of just film work in those years when, again, you're not even a teenager yet. I just want to mention a few things. And if something comes to mind that you can share about it, I mean, Gun Crazy is now considered one of the great film noir movies ever. And it's John Dahl and Peggy Cummins, but you're the young John Dahl in that movie.
Right. Yeah.
Anything that stands out to you about your work on that one in 1950?
What really stands out to me, a couple of things stands out in that movie. Joseph Lewis was the director of that film, and I did a couple of films for him. But he became sort of like my mentor in a way. And I used to go to his house and have dinner, and I knew his daughter well. And we used to go to movies and things like that. And I used to see him. So I really liked him. I really liked him, and I liked his direction. And he gave me a great direction, I remember, that I had to... we did a scene in that where I had a gun, I had a rifle, and I was with another couple of guys, and there was, what the hell was it? I guess it was like a mountain lion that we spotted. Mm-hmm. And so I take the gun up and look, and I can't shoot it. I can't shoot it. And he said, did you ever have a chance with an animal or something that you couldn't shoot like that? And I said, no, but my parents did let me have a BB gun, and I shot a bird one time. It was sitting up on the wires, and I shot up and hit him, and he fell down, and I started to cry because I didn't mean to kill him. And, you know, so that was the first time. He said, well, just think of that when you're holding the gun. So right. I did in the scene turned out great.
Yeah.
And in that film, by the way, was one of the key things that happened because of a timeline was this bank robbery that John Dahl and Cummins did, and they couldn't and they was running out of time, and it was a big scene where they had to go, and then they had to do a shot of the thing running and everything, and a guy coming out and he was waiting in the car. And they said, you got to shoot this in a morning, you know, in one morning. You got to shoot it. By noon, we got to get out of there.
Yeah.
We can't afford to stay there all day. So he put the camera in the back of the car. And I don't know if you remember that scene.
Absolutely.
It was an incredible scene.
Totally.
It was in the back of this back seat of this car, and it followed them, sort of ad-libbing, a turn right up here, you know, and they all the way to the bank. And then they kept the camera in there when he went in or she went in. And it was just an incredible scene. And then he came running out into the car and hopped in it, and off we, they ran.
It's a great one.
Incredible scene.
Now, the same year that Gun Crazy came out, was the year that Father of the Bride came out, and then a year later, the sequel to that, Father's Little Dividend. And I just want to remind people, you are playing the youngest son of Spencer Tracy in this. You are playing the younger brother of Elizabeth Taylor. This is Vincent Minnelli directing. This is some pretty heady company. Did you kind of realize how big a deal these people were, even though you were still so young?
Yeah, I did. I think by then, I think I was 14 or something. So I pretty well knew that, and that Spencer Tracy was this huge star, you know. And the first scene I remember that we did, I didn't have anything to say in it, but Tracy had a big speech where he comes in, and we were all there waiting for him, and finally he came in, and he was kind of mumbling and walking around and saying, now, where do I go over here? And Minnelli said, well, you stand there, and then you come over here, okay, and then what do I say? I said, they're all right, and I move over and say this over here, and what's the line? And he gives him the line, he says, okay, I can't remember that, and then he goes back. And it was like a big scene, and I thought, oh my God, we're going to be here all day. You know, he's going to take forever to do this.
Right.
So finally, Minnelli says, "Okay, do you want to run through it now? Run through it?" And he said, "No, let's just go for it." So they said, "Action!" They turned the camera on, and he just killed it. He just did everything exactly right. You know, it was just,
he was hustling you guys.
Oh yeah. He must have been because I guess that's the way he sort of prepares.
Right.
And he sort of always ad-libbed a little bit anyway.
Yeah.
To make it fresh. And
now you and Elizabeth Taylor must have been roughly contemporaries, right? Were you at the MGM? I know you didn't sign with MGM until after that, but when you're making that movie, were you obligated to be in school at the MGM school?
There? Yes, I was. I was in school with her, and it was her last year, and I even went to her graduation party. And, you know, I've written my memoirs now for the last 25 years.
Yes.
And I have a picture of us that had her graduation in the schoolhouse, and there was myself and Dean Stockwell and an actor named Claude Jarman Jr. who did the movie called The Yearling, and Elizabeth, and So I knew her in that schoolhouse for the time, and I had to stay in that schoolhouse for the remainder of that movie.
Well, so was it because of the success of the two Father of the Bride films that you now get essentially put under contract to MGM? This was at a time, as our listeners may or may not remember, the studio kind of owned you, but it wasn't probably such a bad thing to be owned by MGM if you had to be owned by
it. It was great. Yeah. But I didn't get signed under contract because of those two films. I actually went and did a couple of other movies, The Kid from Cleveland and a couple of others, I think.
Retreat Hell would have been one of those, right?
Well, Retreat Hell, that was for Warner Brothers.
Okay.
And Retreat Hell, the director of that was Joseph Lewis, who I did Gun Crazy for.
Yeah, yeah.
And he took the film, Retreat Hell, and he took it to MGM, and he ran it for MGM for Dori Sherry, who was running the studio at that time. And it was Sherry who looked at it, and they were looking for new actors to put under contract. And so I was one of them, and they signed me under contract. And that's when it was after that I worked at MGM and started working as a contract
player. Now, do you know, I guess you're saying that Lewis was fond of you. Maybe is that the reason why he would have said to Dori Sherry at a totally different studio, check out this movie, maybe to check out this kid?
Yeah, I think so. He ran it, and it was like my agent that I had got an agent by that time. And my agent said that they've offered you a contract because of Retreat Hell, that picture. And that the part that I had in Retreat Hell was great. I played a young Marine. And first they didn't want me. I found out later that they thought I looked too young to play a Marine. And Joseph Lewis actually stood up for me and told the studio, listen, I'm not going to do the film if you don't hire this boy. He's a great actor. And so that's how I got the part.
Amazing. It's good to have a champion.
In Retreat Hill. And I had a great scene in it where I go to find my brother. He's someplace, and there are a bunch of and we shot it at Camp Pendleton. And all of the scene contained all these dead bodies. And my brother was one of them. So I had to lean over this one Marine and cry. Mm-hmm. And he started to laugh, I think. And so they cut, and the sergeant that was in charge of that patrol that said, listen, you guys, you're leaving in 2 weeks to go to Korea, so you better it's not so funny as you think it is.
Yeah.
And so we got through the scene, and oddly enough, the whole platoon was killed in the battle. So that was kind of tragic.
Well, so at MGM, I don't think it was even necessarily your first movie, but the first movie for MGM that really popped, I think, would be Seven Brides for Seven Brothers.
No, actually, the first film I did there was called Take the High Ground.
Okay.
And that was an army movie about with Richard Widmark and Carl Malden.
Sure.
And I played and it was about young boys becoming soldiers and, becoming soldiers. So that was my first one. And it was after that Seven Brides for Seven Brothers came up. And I got that by accident because the director, actually the choreographer, Michael Kidd, wanted all the brothers except for Howard Keel. But the six brothers, he wanted all of them to be great dancers. Mm-hmm. But what happened was the studio said, no, you've got to have at least two of them. You can have four great dancers, and then you've got to get used two of our actors.
Who are under contract.
That are under contract. So the two actors were Jeff Richards, who hated dancing. he thought all dancers were sissies, and he hated it. And I was the other one.
Right.
And
now, they didn't know that you actually could dance.
Well, that I did. I couldn't do that kind of dancing, though, but I did. But I was a street dancer, and I could move around great. And I'd been a tumbler in high school, a good one. So he said, I heard you're a tumbler. And I said, yeah. And I did a backflip for him right away. He says, oh, my God, that's great. I'm doing this big number called a barn dance number. And I can use you in that. And I said, well, wait a minute, Michael. I can't dance with Jacques Dambois from the New York City Ballet and Mark Platt and Matt Maddox, Tommy Rawl. I said, these guys are great dancers. And he said, this is just square dancing. And so he talked me into it. And I did it. And oddly enough, I was, I kind of stood out.
Yeah.
Because in the movie, in Seven Brides, we were all these backwoodsmen. And they were all ballet dancers. And there was a number in there called Going Courtin', where Janie Powell teaches us, you know, how to dance. And I was the only one that looked like he didn't know how to dance. Everyone else stood up, you know, in right. a perfect, in a fifth position. And so it was pretty funny that I ended up in that dance just jumping up and down and then falling down.
Oh, it's amazing.
Yeah, it was a great part.
Well, we should remind people this is Gideon Pontoppi. He's the youngest of the seven backwoodsmen who go out looking for brides, right? And I want to come back to that barn dance number, though, because you're saying, you know, you weren't a professional dancer in the way that some of these other guys were, but it's pretty unbelievable the degree to which, like, what you guys all did in that scene. And so I wonder if you can talk about, I had read that Donnan, who obviously had worked very closely with Gene Kelly, brought Gene Kelly in to kind of see what you guys could do.
He after we learned that number, I think like the last day we came back from lunch and Michael Kidd was late coming in. And when he did come in, he came in with Gene Kelly and he introduced Gene to all the cast and they said he wants to see the number. So we were all really excited that we were going to do it for Gene Kelly. And we went through the whole number and, as much as of it as we could, except that one of the dancers had to get up on a well and he was on a rope. He's the only one that did that had to be on a trick, so he didn't do that trick. But anyway, we finished the number, and when we finished, Gene Kelly looked at us all and he said, "That was great, you guys." He said, "There's nothing left for you to do but bleed." I'll never forget
that
line.
That's a pretty nice person to get a compliment from. So for somebody who, again, I know you, even now you say, you know, you kind of downplay your dancing, but you worked with just about every great choreographer there was. And so we've talked about Michael Kidd, who was one of the best. Now I got to ask you about Hermes Pan, who I think was Astaire's choreographer.
He was Fred Astaire's choreographer almost all of his movies. But
and now you're like just a year after Seven Brides, you guys are together on Hit the Deck. Was he, you know, if you could sort of say like maybe, you know, what made Michael Kidd special versus what made Hermes Pan special, is there anything you can point out that you remember?
Well, they both were really nice guys, and nice choreographers and easy to get along with and very different from like Jerome Robbins, who was
a jerk,
who was pretty nasty at times.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you missed a step too many times, he'd make you sit in a corner with like a dunce, you know.
Oh my God! And we'll of course come to him.
And also Alex Romero, you know. And for years I told people I never danced, and when they would ask me, and he said, "Well, wait a minute, didn't you work for Hermes Pan and Alex Romero and Jerome Robbins,
Michael
and Hermes Pan, Michael Kidd, all of them?" And I said, "Yes, I did." And he said, "Well, then you not only had dance experience, but you worked with the masters."
Totally.
And I thought about that, and I thought, "Yeah, well, that's true. That's so." I never again said I'd never studied dancing.
Right. You know? Good.
It was on the job training.
That's it. Now, for Hit the Deck, you win a Golden Globe for Most Promising Newcomer, doing more incredible dancing the next year in The Fastest Gun Alive. I think on Shovels you're dancing.
Yeah.
I mean, this is, so it's building and building. Also, I think chronologically around that time would have been when you were kind of unofficially consulted by a person to help him learn how to dance for a movie? Was there, were you approached by one Elvis Presley?
Oh, yeah. Not so much a pro. It kind of happened. He was, I met him before when he was at MGM doing, when he was going to do Jailhouse Rock. But he used to come to my beach house all the time. And, But I went on the set because Alex Romero was a good friend of mine, you know, had done the choreography for a couple of films. And that's where when Elvis was there, I was on the set and I knew we were like sort of friends then. So he said, listen, can you... Do you think you could help me with a couple of steps? And I said, sure. So we went in the back of the hall. And so I helped him with his legs, oddly enough, and the thing he was famous
right.
for. I got the, he would do that thing where one knee would go into the other like
right,
that, you
right.
know. And so I worked with him and I showed him how to do it even easier and a little bigger than he was doing it. Yeah. He was doing it kind of small and I made him do it. Didn't make him, but I suggested he do it bigger.
That's cool.
So I actually co-created, you know, choreographed it.
Yeah, that's awesome. Now, what did it mean to you a year later? You've got Paid in Place and you are, just to remind folks, playing this guy, Norman, sort of shy, emotionally abused by his mother. Just it's a different sort of part than I think anyone had seen you play. And you get nominated for an Oscar.
Yeah.
Did
true.
That mean a lot to you to have
yeah,
that kind of recognition?
Well,
from
it
your-
did. Yeah. It did. But, you know, later on, many years later, I thought, you know, I wish that I'd waited a little longer before, before I got nominated because, I was very young at that time. Mm-hmm. Very, I think I was like 19 or 20 or something. But that's really too young to get an Academy Award nomination.
In the sense that it's just hard to then find another great role right after, do you mean? Or like hard to capitalize on the nomination?
It's hard to appreciate
yeah.
what a big deal it was
right.
to get nominated. You know, and it was very, very exciting.
Yeah. Well, just I know we're not going to do every year of your life, but that you've had so much that you packed in. I got to yeah. mention the year that you were nominated was also the year that you're in, probably having already shot prior to the nomination, but you're in a movie that's sort of got a cult following now as, you know, just a snapshot of social attitudes at the time. This is High School Confidential.
Oh, yeah.
And you're playing a police informant who infiltrates a drug ring. God forbid, you know, marijuana be smoked anywhere. Would you ever have imagined that that's a movie that we'd be talking about 65 years later?
No, I would never have imagined it. But it was great fun. And I became friends with Jackie Coogan on that, who was one of the actors in the movie. And we used to smoke pot together. In fact, when I went in the Army, he said, I'll send you some when you're in the Army. And I was in the Army in Oklahoma. And sure enough, a cake arrived one day. And and it didn't even say who it was from, except, it was his character, and I forget what his character's name was in that now.
Oh, he sent it as the name of the guy he played it
yeah,
in High
School
Confidential.
Yeah, so sent it, and I looked at it and thought, oh, my God, that must be Jackie. And so, you know, I cut open the cake, and there was a bag of pot. I can talk about that now.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
now
great.
It's
yeah, nobody
legal.
Cares anymore.
Nobody cares anymore.
Now, there were a couple of movies in which you played Tom Thumb for George Pell. There's Tom Thumb in 58. There's The Wonderful World of the Brothers Grimm
a lot
in
of movies.
62. This is just the variety and all of that. I know it was not I was going to say it's a small part, but that could be interpreted multiple
times. I've used that so many times when somebody said, you were in Tom Thumb. I said, yeah, that was one of my smaller parts. And sometimes people don't even get it.
Right,
you know,
right. Well, this, though, brings us to the one that probably for eternity, I would imagine, you'll be most associated with, and that is West Side Story. And I, you know, if anyone has been living under a rock for the last 60-whatever years. We'll just remind them you are Riff, who is the leader of the Jets, who the first person we see in the movie when it starts, and basically this whole sequence that leads up to you coming face-to-face with George Chakiris as the leader of the Sharks.
Bernardo,
yeah. Yes. You were 22, I believe, when that movie was made.
Boy, I don't remember how old I was. But I think I was older.
Maybe even a little older.
I may have been. I don't remember now.
But you had the thing that it's one of these crazy things, I guess, in life that it almost didn't happen because you were already cast in Where the Boys Are, right?
No, what happened was, is it's very funny, is that I actually tested for the part of Tony, which was, you know, which was the Romeo and Juliet. Yeah. Natalie Wood was Juliet. I actually tested for that part, and I even tested with actresses that were up for the part of Maria, and MGM let me go and practice. But finally, Robert Wise, who we happened to have the same agent, so I was calling him all the time, asking him, you know, how close is it? And he said, well, you're still in the mix. And then finally he called one time and said, oh, I'm sorry, but they gave the part of Tony to another actor, to Richard Beamer. Mm-hmm. But they've offered you the role of Riff. And I was just astonished. I said, Riff? I said, that never, ever occurred to me. And he said, well, do you want to do it or not? And I said, yes. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. I jumped at it. So that was the first time that I had a meeting with Jerome Robbins, and Jerry said to me the first time when I went in and met him after I got the part of Riff, and he said, now I got to tell you right off, he said, I've seen your movies and you've always done acrobatic dancing in there. And I said, there'll be no acrobats. He said, Riff is not a tumbler. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to have to do all straight dancing. And it wasn't until we went way overboard, way over the time in New York, we spent a couple of months, mm-hmm. and the studio was furious because they were running out of money. Yeah. So they said, so they fired Jerry.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was his assistant, Tony Mordente, mm-hmm. Who said, let's put some tumbling back in the movie.
Okay.
So I did a tumbling in the...
But just to go backwards for a second, first of all, had you seen... I mean, West Side Story had been a hit on Broadway, right?
Yeah.
Years before the movie. Had you happened to see it, or did you know basically what you were...
No, I saw it.
You did.
And I was in the Army there, but I went there on a tour in the Army, not for any Army reason, but I had another movie coming out. I can't remember what it was, but I went on tour. I think it was Tom Thumb.
To New York.
I went, and I went to several cities, and one of them New York.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I saw the play, and I just fell in love with the part of Tony.
Yeah.
And I learned Something's Coming, and I learned his songs, and went back and used to play it and study it. And so that's what MGM sent me over to Warner Brothers to audition with actresses that were up for the part of
right.
Maria. And then finally they gave the part, well, I think I said...
To Beamer,
I
don't
know,
yeah.
Repeat myself,
no,
to
no,
Beamer.
That's okay.
But when they offered me the part of Riff, I said, great, I'll do it. But the studio turned it down.
MGM, who you were still under
yeah.
contract to, didn't want you to go to Fox to do West Side Story?
Right.
Unless you were the lead.
Unless I was the lead. So, and I was furious, and I wanted to do it so badly that I finally made an appointment with... Who was running the studio then?
Benny Thaw would have
Benny
been.
Benny Thaw.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Benny, and I went into his big office and walked down and his big desk. And he said, now listen, Russ, he said, I know you want to do this movie, but he said, you can't do it. And these are the lines you have to read, you know, my father wears a dress, my mother, whatever, all those lines, you know.
Kindly, Sergeant Krupke, you gotta understand, it's just our bringing up key that gets us out of hand. Our mothers all are junkies, our fathers all are drunks. Golly Moses, naturally we're punks.
Gee, Officer Krupke, we're very upset. We never had the love that every child ought to get.
We ain't no delinquents, we're misunderstood. Deep down inside us, there is good.
There is good, there is good.
And he said, so you have all these things and you have a good reputation here and you, we don't want you doing this. And we've put you in a movie that we think will be really better for you called Where the Boys Are.
Okay.
And with Connie Francis. And that'll be much better for you. So they actually had me cast for that movie. I was never in it.
Oh, my God.
So not only wasn't I in it, I never saw it. But here's the weird thing. I got started getting residuals and lots of thousands and thousands of dollars for that movie. And I never even was on the set.
Well, I'm glad. That's good. That's I hope you had fun with it. But now, so what did you say to Benny Thought to change his mind?
Well, I told him, I said, please, Benny, I really, really want to do it. And then, you know, I found out later that then somebody from in the studio, someone told me later that was one of the executives at MGM said, well, the reason that they didn't want you to do it is they wanted to get more money. So they ended up, because I was under contract,
right.
I was making my usual $2,000 a week or whatever it was. And so they got like $7,500. So they got all the extra money for that. And then it was for a long shoot.
Oh, my gosh.
So I said, well, you know, what the hell? That made me not care so much about taking the residuals for a movie I never did.
Now, what's it like working for two directors? Because we had Robert Wise, who I think was primarily doing the non-dancing stuff, and then Jerome Robbins, who's doing the dancing stuff. But did they get along? Would they both be there for everything? What was your experience with the two of them?
Well, they had the agreement was that that Jerome Robbins would direct the dancers and the dance routines, and Robert Wise would direct the drama. Mm-hmm. So all of the drama in it was directed by Bob.
Mm-hmm. And as you sort of referenced a little while ago, it doesn't sound like it was, you know, we all know it turned out to be this great classic movie, but it wasn't a particularly smooth experience making it. I just want to, you mentioned they went over budget and got shut down for a little while. You've talked about the fact that for whatever reason, they chose to shoot in the hottest part of the summer.
Yeah, true.
Like over 100 degrees, I heard at times. They had to pay off the gangs, I guess, around Lincoln Center area, what's now Lincoln Center?
Well, it wasn't gangs. It was a gang that area that was sort of controlled that area.
Yeah.
So we hired them to watch the set. And so they were around all the time. And they were a gang. And then somebody sort of, there was a knife fight. I remember somebody got stabbed that was trying to get in on the set. And and the gang stabbed them. So it was kind of a little tragic.
Never
a dull moment.
Well, and then the biggest problem, it sounds like, we had Rita Moreno on the podcast a couple of years ago, and she's talking, as you have, as has everybody, that Jerome Robbins was just basically an SOB. So what he was just, do you think he was just a sadistic guy, or what was it?
Well, it wasn't even our opinion. I mean, there was a book called Dancing with Demons that was about Jerome Robbins, and he had and I think because he was, he had this, he was gay, but he had this masculine problem that he wanted to be, you know, he wanted to be straight, but couldn't do it. So I think that's why he took out a lot of the meanness at time. He would get mean. If somebody missed a step, they'd have to sit in the corner, you know.
Or I'd heard that sometimes you guys would spend forever on a dance routine and then he'd ask you to do it on the other foot.
Yeah.
What's that about?
That's one of the reasons why we went overboard.
Yeah.
Or over
budget, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Is because of that, where we had to dance all the way down the street. And he said, I'd like to see all of you do it on the other foot. And boy, for a dancer, I mean, that's, you got to be a really good dancer to do that.
Unbelievable.
But so everybody had to study and do it. And so he was kind of crazy like that. I thought he was overrated in a lot of ways because the actual film itself was, even without him, was even after they fired him. I mean, you know, the film still came out well.
Yeah, and I guess the first time you might have really realized that for yourself would be sort of a premiere. And we talked earlier about a great compliment you got from Gene Kelly. If Gene Kelly's not the best movie dancer ever, it probably is Fred Astaire. And I think he was at that premiere of West Side Story too, right?
I was at that premiere and I was in the movie, and it was called an invitational premiere.
Yeah.
So everybody from the business, the producers, directors, actors, they all came and filled up the theater. It was at the Carthay Circle. It's not there anymore. But when the movie ended and everybody stood up and gave it a standing ovation, and we were walking out and people were saying, Russ, and capping me on the shoulder and saying, gee, that was a great performance, a great movie and everything. It's thank you. And then finally I got a tap on the shoulder and I turned around and it was Fred Astaire. And I looked at him and he said, Russ, I got to tell you something. He said, I'm a big fan of your dancing. And I was like, what?
That doesn't get
and
better
that's
than
all
that,
I could
right?
think of the rest of the day. And I went home at night and told my wife, I said, I can't believe it. You know, Fred Astaire says he's a fan of my dancing.
That's awesome. That's quite a compliment. So we mentioned that Robbins was a bit sadistic. Another person who I've learned had a pretty sadistic streak, I just introduced over at the Hollywood Legion Theater as part of this festival, a screening of Mr. Roberts, which was directed initially by John Ford before he got taken off that movie for, you know, he claimed he had gallbladder issues or something, but he was really just being terrible towards the actors. And apparently that was also the case on How the West Was Won with the guy who he's most closely associated with, John Wayne. Everybody thinks it's this great relationship. You were in that movie playing a Confederate deserter. What did you see?
Well, I saw him treating John Wayne like nobody else was ever allowed to, that nobody else did. But I saw him, and I was in a scene with Wayne, and we're kind of at a distance. I was going to shoot him.
Yeah.
And didn't get at it. They shot me. George Papard shot me instead.
Yes.
But I heard him directing Wayne, and they say, cut, and they say, John, Jesus Christ, when in the fuck are you going to learn how to, when are you going to learn how to act? You know? And oh, my God, he's talking to John Wayne.
Right.
And John Wayne said, yes, sir, you know. And
he just took it.
Oh, yeah, totally took it.
Wow. And this is after they've already been working. I mean, I think the first time they worked together was Stagecoach. That's 23 years earlier. So after 23 years, he's still giving him crap. Wow.
And he was quite a character. He had a scarf that he wore. He had a patch over his eye and had and he had a handkerchief in his pocket. And when you were acting, he used to come over with it and wipe makeup on you, you know. And
oh, my goodness.
So he was quite a character.
Now, you didn't, I don't know, I guess you worked at least twice with Joseph H. Lewis, we talked about. I don't know how many others you worked multiple times with, but one of them for sure is Robert Wise, because you guys did West Side Story, comes out
in
61, and then The Haunting in 63. But I know I've heard you talk about it. It's now, I think you say, one of your favorites that you did, but you didn't want to do it when they first asked you to do it, right?
That's true. I read it and didn't like the part. I was just dumb on my part, because it was the one character in the movie that didn't believe in ghosts, you know, and had no and just wanted to sell it for its for the money,
right?
Because I was the nephew who I was a nephew,
the heir to the mansion,
who was the heir to the mansion, and so that was pretty, you know, pretty weird. It was a part that I did not want to do and turned it down. And MGM said, no, you will do this movie or we'll put you on suspension,
right?
Which meant you get no money from
that
them for
so
a
good.
Long time.
Yeah.
So I said, all right, I'll do it. And actually, I flew back to the States because I was making that the other Connie Francis movie that I ended up doing called... Follow the Boys.
Yeah.
And
maybe that's where they got the residuals mixed up.
I don't know what no, but because I was definitely. He said we've already planned to put you in where the boys are. So I was on the payroll.
What a great clerical error!
Whoa, it was a great. I didn't cash the checks for a long time. I waited for about a year, and I thought, you know, in case they're going to say, "Oh, we made a mistake here."
You too late.
Well, so I finally cashed them.
So that MGM contract, which you signed, I think initially in 1952, it ends in I don't know if it was always set to end at a certain time, but it ended, I think, in 1964. Now, it seems like around that time, maybe you were growing a little bit disillusioned with acting, or at least enchanted by other things, because to use your words and a phrase that I guess it's less known today, but like essentially you dropped out. What did that mean, and why did that happen?
Well, I did. It was later than that that I dropped out. I was in the Army for 2 years of the get contract obligation, and then when I came out, they let me out early to do a movie called Cimarron with Glenn Ford that I made two or three movies with. Mm-hmm. I think I made three with Glenn. Mm-hmm. So anyway, it wasn't till later, I think, that I met a writer named Henry Miller, who was a big avant-garde, and we became friends. And so I got really turned on to avant-garde art. And it was through after Henry that I met another artist named Wallace Berman, who was a West Coast known for being the father of West Coast art. Mm-hmm. And he became my good friends and turned me on to, and I moved up to Topanga Canyon and dropped out because I was tired of the performing arts. I wanted to get into fine art, and I did. And the difference I always said was the difference is that in the performing arts, you do whatever you can to make your heads to make the audience's head spin.
Right, right.
But in fine art, you do whatever you can to make your own head spin. And so that's what I got into, and it was much more gratifying than.
And you eventually came back to acting, but do you think that you just kind of maybe, aside from being into the new art that you were discovering, were you also just in need of a break? You'd been acting since you were probably as far back as you could remember. Do you think it was just...
Well, it had a lot to do with money because,
okay.
You know, in art, I would do art and I would do a series of pieces and have an exhibition, a show, and sell the art. And I would make like maybe $3,000 or $4,000 for a year. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a year's work, yeah. You know. And it was just, it was really hard. Yeah. It was hard supporting my wife and myself.
Yeah.
So that's when I thought, gee, maybe I should look for work again. But it was by accident that Dane Stockwell did that movie. He did the movie with Dennis Hopper.
Was it Blue Velvet?
Yeah. It was Blue Velvet.
Yeah.
And afterwards, I was living with I was living with Dane then, and so he said that he said, listen, you want to go with me to David Lynch is having a birthday party and at Dennis's house. So I went there with Dane, and that was where there was a moment when David was opening up cards, you know, birthday cards and everything. And he came across this one, and it was a picture of a guy with a bunch of pretty girls around him, you know?
Yeah.
And I was standing next to him, and he said, oh, wow. He said, hey, wouldn't you love to be this guy, Russ? And it was an opportunity. And I said, you know what, David, what I really would like is to work for you sometime.
Wow.
And he looked at me and he said, next movie I do. And of course, in Hollywood, you know, that means nothing.
Right.
But sure enough, like a year later, pretty soon I got a call from my agent, said, you know, David Lynch wants to see you. And I went to see him and he said, now the part I want you to do is Dr. Jacoby, this eccentric doctor and
psychiatrist, I guess.
So yeah. I ended up, and I left, and I remember thinking to myself, my God, he didn't say the part I'm thinking of you for that I want you to try out for. He said, the part I want you to do. And I remember I went home, and and was thrilled when I did it.
That's amazing. Yeah, Twin Peaks had the first incarnations, 1990 to 1991. Then it came back around in 2017, where you were again playing that guy and with his glasses, which are kind of interesting. The one, what was it, a blue lens and a red lens of the glasses?
Yeah, I actually went to, I live in Santa Monica, and so I went down to Venice, the Venice walkway, and I walked along, and I decided I wanted to get some colored glasses to wear. And so I kept looking at different glasses, and I narrowed it down to these two glasses, to a pair of red glasses and a pair of blue glasses. And I kept changing them, looking in the mirror, trying to figure out which, you know, what would be best. And finally, I took and put one lens over this and the other one over the other one. I looked and I said, which one? And I said, both of them.
That's it.
So I had a pair made, and I went to a glasses place and had them make me a pair. And I took them to David Lynch and said, "Hey, what do you think? I'd like to wear these glasses with the doctor." And I explained, because I said the red lens makes it brighter, and the blue lens calms everything down. Yeah. So he looked at it, he says, "Russ," he had a high voice, and he said, "Russ, I think that's a great idea, but you know what? Let's not tell anybody what it's about." So
there you go. Well, last minute or two, if I can, I just have to ask you a few sort of assorted random things. One of them, I wonder if there's a part that you ever passed on that you wish you hadn't. I mean, I've heard that you were offered, for instance, Gilligan in Gilligan's Island. Is
that
true?
That's true. I think that was probably but then, you know, later on I thought about it, and I thought, you know, if I'd have done that part, I probably would have become a junkie or something, because I needed to stop acting. Because it was around that time that I walked away from Hollywood.
Right.
That I did that. That was probably the biggest. I did want to mention, too, that one of my favorite working experiences was playing opposite Debbie Reynolds in Hit the Deck.
Oh, really?
And that was just because she was so sweet and so much fun.
Yeah.
And we had such a great time.
It's good together. To know. How about more recently, in 2011, you did Drive. And in 2012, you did Django Unchained. So these are two of the more eccentric, modern, hip filmmakers now, Nicholas Winding Refn and Quentin Tarantino.
True.
Again, there are not too many people who will have worked for both Cecil B. DeMille and Quentin Tarantino.
True. Well, I don't think anyone else.
I don't think so either. So I guess I just wonder, you know, being a part of sort of this new era, the current era of movies as well, and seeing how much things have changed, and maybe some things haven't. Just what were your impressions of on those more recent projects?
Well, it was pretty small. I actually did I went to a party that on a Sunset Strip that Tilda Swinton did. We became friends with, because she did a movie with my daughter.
Yes.
And they became very close. And she said, "Well, if you ever come to Scotland, come and visit me." And so we went to Scotland, and my wife Bonnie and I and Amber all took a train and went up to the top end of the northern part of Scotland to where she lived. And saw her there, and we became good friends. So she came back and did a benefit, and I forget what the benefit was for, but it was a benefit, and it was put on by Quentin Tarantino and Tilda Swinton, and I went there, and I didn't mention that I went on an interview with Quentin Tarantino for the first movie that he did. And I guess he was very nervous.
For Reservoir Dogs.
For the Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, I went in there and auditioned for a part, and he was kind of rude.
Oh.
And he said, "Jesus, what happened to you, Russ?" And he said, "Thanks for coming in, but what happened to you?" And I had disappeared a little bit and gone into art. And And it was because of him saying that that I just wanted to, I wanted to not have to do that anymore. So that's when I got rid of my agents and dropped out. So at the, I had no agents or no manager anymore. So at this party, I had a choice. I saw Quentin, and I had a couple of drinks. You know, so I went over and sort of nailed him against the wall and said, "Quentin, you know, because of you, I dropped out of show business." And he said, "What?" And I said, "Yeah." I said, "Because of that interview, and you said something like, 'What happened to you?'" And he said, "Oh, well, I didn't mean it. I'm a big fan of yours." And so he started quoting scenes. He started quoting scenes that I had done and movies that they said, "Oh, my favorite movie, one of my favorite movies is Son of a Gunfighter," which was a Western I did in Spain. And then he quoted lines. And in another one, he quoted a speech that I did. And so I felt bad after that. I thought, Jesus, you know, I shouldn't have said those things to him. So later on, Amber came back and she was friends with him, and she said, and he's. And he said to Amber, he said, "Boy," he said, "your dad was really pissed off at me." And he said, "What can I do?" And she said, "Put him in your next movie."
Yeah.
So that's when the movie came up, and he gave me that.
That's awesome.
And I had that.
And you played a son of a gunfighter in Django, right? That was the connection.
That was the billing he gave me, too.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he billed Amber as a daughter of a gunfighter, which
that's
is
great.
Pretty funny.
Well, so just to close, you've mentioned your daughter Amber, who's turned out to be an excellent actress as well. And I enjoyed from when she was very young and starting out to since then. I think you, as a child actor, one time yourself, probably had an interesting perspective on what she was going through and managed her when she was a kid, and now she's...
I managed her, and she was... and I used to go to... and she got this soap opera, General Hospital, that she did for a couple of years. And I used to go... my mother went and watched her because she had to have an adult...
Guardian,
Guardian there. So I used to go and watch her, and I'd stand behind the camera and watch her. And she just had a great natural talent, you know, but I would either give her a thumbs up or call her over and tell her something, technical thing usually of, you know, if the camera's here and don't turn around the other way, but turn this way, you know.
Right. But you must be very, you know, proud of her. And I just wonder, you know, for people listening who are wondering, you know, what's life like today? You know, do you still have any desire to act? Do you prefer, you know, maybe you do things like golf or who knows what, but just what's life like today?
Well, I'm retired now. I really don't want to do any. I can barely walk now from all those years of tumbling
and
flipping over everything. And I'm 88 and have a hard time memorizing even too. So I'm happy just, I've written my book, you know, Dancing on the Edge, that I've been working on for 25 years.
Great title.
And it's got all my stories in it, some great stories in it. You know, stories, and I always try to get good ones. Like for instance, I drove off the MGM lot one time with Paul Newman in my trunk, and that's all explained in the book. But a lot of wild stories like that.
I bet. Well, and it's so where does that stand? It's coming.
We got a publisher, a Blackstone publishing company, and we're going through a period now where I've edited it all, and so they're reading it now to do an edit.
That's the way it happens with
books. So they're doing an edit, and then we're going to go back and forth. And then it's supposed to come out in April of next year.
That's exciting. So, I mean,
really exciting.
Anyone who's listened to this, it whets their appetite, and then they'll go and get that for the full story. And in the meantime, thank you so much for all the great entertainment over the years. Thank you for doing this.
Well, thank you for the interview.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate it and would really appreciate you taking just a minute more to subscribe to the podcast and to leave us a rating and review on your podcast app. and to follow us on Twitter and Instagram, where our handle is at Awards Chatter. On those platforms, we announce upcoming guests and provide details about special live recordings of the podcast that you can attend. Until next time, thanks again for tuning in.